Welcome to the 50th episode of Beyond Barbarossa, the first English language podcast in the world to focus on the Eastern Front of World War II. I'm Scott Burry, and I'm very excited to bring you this special episode, number 50. All have been recorded in the Redbeard Studio on traditional Anishinaabeg Algonquin territory, also called Ottawa. We're now at the halfway point in the war. As you know, I've been trying to track, chronologically, the development of the war in the East. That way, I hope to get around one of the major obstacles to appreciating the history of World War II. The way history programs tend to present the war, first in like North Africa as one piece, then the war in Italy as another piece, and then the war on the Eastern Front as another piece, and then the Second Front, and so on. It's harder to understand or see how all these things are actually happening at the same time. This podcast began on 22nd June 2022, describing the events of 22nd June 1941, the very start of the invasion called Operation Barbarossa. So now, 50 episodes on, 23 months into the war in the East, we stand at the midpoint of the war. I don't think I'm dropping any spoilers here to point out that the early summer of 1943 is about the halfway point in the war on the Eastern Front, from June 1941 to May 1945. And I think that this is a good time for this podcast to not really pause, but to take a look back, take stock from the vantage point of the middle of the conflict. June 1941 is pretty much understood as the start date of the Second World War on the Eastern Front, as 3 million men of the German Wehrmacht assaulted the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics, a state that had less than 2 years earlier signed a treaty of non-aggression and friendship with Germany. Now, you all know that both sides had been gearing up for a war for a long time before that. In fact, all of Europe had been since the early 1930s. And throughout the 1930s, the USSR had the largest military in the world, and all the other countries knew that. By 1939, there were over 5 million men enlisted, distributed across the geographically largest nation in the world. And its monthly output of war material was almost as big as the entire complement of countries like Germany or the UK, which made some, including senior Soviet leaders, doubt that Germany would ever attack. As I said, one of my goals for this podcast is to look at how all the different events, all the different theaters of war affect one another. In the West, it's generally accepted that the 1st of September, 1939, is the starting point of the Second World War, the day that Germany invaded Poland. But there is another way to look at it, another earlier starting date. In 1931, Imperial Japan invaded Manchuria in the northern part of China. By 1932, the Japanese had established the puppet state of Manchukuo. Then in 1937, the Marco Polo Bridge incident sparked the Second Sino-Japanese War. Some historians point to this as the true beginning of the Second World War. The competing factions in the Chinese Civil War, the Nationalists and the Communists, came together in the Second United Front to resist the Japanese, who nonetheless captured China's then capital, Nanking. You've heard of the Rape of Nanking? The Japanese proceeded to take more and more territory. The League of Nations was impotent to do anything about the situation in China. And this impotence did not go unnoticed by the imperialistic dictators in Europe. In 1935, Italy invaded the country of Abyssinia, now called Ethiopia, on the Horn of Africa. And in 1938, Germany annexed Austria, claiming that it wanted to unite the German ethnic people. Diplomatic objections again amounted to nothing. Months later, German dictator Adolf Hitler announced spurious justifications for seizing a third of Czechoslovakia, called the Sudetenland. Britain and France again responded with talks. The Munich Conference recognized German sovereignty over that part of Czechoslovakia. And then, 3 months later, Hitler decided to take the rest of the country. In April 1939, fascist Italy, under the control of dictator Benito Mussolini, invaded the little and poor country of Albania, just across the Adriatic Sea. This would have massive consequences. That June, still 1939, the USSR sent a young general named Georgi Zhukov to bring about some kind of resolution to the skirmishing along the Soviet-Mongolian-Manchurian border with the forces of Imperial Japan. Zhukov decisively defeated the Japanese at the Battle of Khalkhin Gol, using tactics that presaged the war in Russia, Belarus, and Ukraine. Days after signing a ceasefire agreement in the Far East, and once the Soviet spies made it clear that Japan would not invade the USSR but focus on the Pacific, the USSR signed the Treaty of Non-Aggression between Germany and the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics. Most call it the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact. This pact included clauses about increasing trade and guaranteeing that neither country would go to war against the other. That was the public side of it. There were also secret clauses that did not become apparent until much later. Clauses that divided Eastern Europe into separate spheres of influence, in effect giving Germany sway over half of Poland and granting the eastern half of Poland to the USSR, along with Finland, Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania. Germany was recognized as having a sphere of influence that included the rest of Western Europe. They signed this agreement on 23rd August 1939. Again, and the Soviet Union would not sign the agreement, would not agree, until it knew that Japan was no longer a threat. And then, a week after they signed it, 1st September 1939, Germany invaded Poland because it knew that the USSR would not object. 2 weeks after that, the USSR invaded Poland from the east. And this, in effect, brought about a fourth partition of Poland and led to its erasure from the European map until the end of the war. So this is what I mean, how developments in one part of the world can have rapid consequences half a world away. Zhukov's victory at Khalkhin Gol enabled the USSR to take over half of Poland. At this point, it's on. With the invasion of Poland, Britain and France declared war on Germany. France sent forces into Germany just over its border, but they withdrew soon after. Thus commenced the phony war, as the British and French basically did nothing but watch Germany and the Soviet Union brutalize Poland and then strengthen their own position. The German and Soviet partition of Poland was over by the 28th of September, as the two invaders signed an agreement setting their border. Meanwhile, the USSR began overtly pressuring the Baltic countries, Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania, including violating their airspace, so that they would install communist-friendly, meaning communist, governments, and to accept Red Army and Navy bases on their territory. Then we come to the Winter War. On 26 November 1939, this is, what, 2 months after taking over Poland, the Soviet Union invaded Finland, starting the Winter War. The Winter War would turn out to be a disaster for the USSR, at least until January 1940, as the Finns, who had a tiny population at the time, with a volunteer army, inflicted incredible casualties on the Red Army. Overall, the Soviets lost five times as many men, material, tanks, planes, and everything else than the Finns did. For more on the Winter War, go back to the bonus episodes on it, of this podcast, or you can get the full series on the Winter War for Patreon supporters. So now we're at 1940. In January, with the Winter War going very badly for them, the Soviets replace the commander in the north, General Voroshilov, with the up-and-coming General Semyon Timoshenko. Timoshenko changed the strategy and ultimately wore the Finns down until they sued for peace in March 1940. At great cost, the casualty rate didn't really change. The Finns had to give up 9% of their territory to the Soviet Union, as well as make a number of other concessions. Then that April, the Soviet NKVD, the secret security police, murdered 22,000 Polish military officers, policemen, and intelligentsia, depositing their bodies in a mass grave in the Katyn Woods. Then Germany invaded Denmark, which surrendered in hours. They really had no choice. Germany also sent its navy to Norwegian ports, capturing Oslo, then Narvik in the north, Trondheim, and the rest of the country. Britain and France talked about sending troops to help, but it was all over before they could act. In May, the Western Blitzkrieg began as German forces invaded the Low Countries and France. The Low Countries fell surprisingly fast. In the midst of the Battle of France, the British had an election, putting Winston Churchill in charge of the government. The Battle of France proved the worth of the Blitzkrieg strategy and hurrying Heinz Guderian's tactics of tank warfare. On 12 June, Italian and German air and naval forces began the siege of Malta, a strategic UK colony in the Mediterranean Sea between Italy and Libya. By the middle of June, the Germans have occupied Paris, Marshal Philippe Pétain has become a Nazi puppet, and the USSR has occupied all the Baltic states. This becomes the era of governments and military forces in exile, with legitimate governments from Norway, the Netherlands, Belgium, Luxembourg, Poland, Czechoslovakia, and more setting up in London or other places. General Charles de Gaulle set up a free French government in exile in London and then moved it to Brazzaville in the French colony of Congo. With the fall of France began the Battle of Britain in the skies over southern England and the London Blitz. In August 1940, the USSR annexed Bessarabia and northern Bukovina from Romania. These were long-time Russian aims. Now, it did not please Germany, but remember they had this treaty of friendship and non-aggression, so Germany's hands were kind of tied. In northern China, in August 1940, the communists launched a campaign against the Japanese occupiers they called the 100 Regiments Offensive. In September, the Lend-Lease program got underway, at least unofficially, as the British traded land in the Caribbean for 50 old U.S. naval destroyers. In Africa, meanwhile, Italian forces in Libya began the invasion of British-held Egypt in an effort to seize control of the Suez Canal. This would cut off vital British supplies from India and other sources in the East and the Pacific. Speaking of farther east, the Japanese occupied French Indochina, today's Vietnam, Cambodia, Laos, and as well as some southern Chinese territory. In October, Italy launched an invasion of Greece. This did not make their German allies too happy. And again, it's something that would have long-term major consequences. In November 1940, Hungary, Romania, and the Nazi puppet state Slovakia signed the Tripartite Pact, joining the Axis. Through the winter of 1941, the focus of the war was in North Africa as the Italian forces engaged with the British Commonwealth armies back and forth across Libya. Farther south, the British launched a counteroffensive against the Italians in Eritrea. In February, German General Erwin Rommel was named in charge of German troops in North Africa, a group that would soon be known as the Africa Corps. Rommel would proceed to give the British hell. In Indochina, the Vichy French, which is the puppet of Germany at this point, scored a victory against Thailand at the Battle of Koh Chang. In March, a bloodless coup deposed Prince Regent Paul of Yugoslavia, who had agreed to join the Nazi Tripartite Pact. The coup replaced the regent with the King Peter, who refused to join the Nazis and was more pro-British. Again, this did not make Germany happy. So, Germany attacked Yugoslavia and Greece on the 6th of April. The Yugoslavian government surrendered on the 17th, and Greece surrendered 10 days later on the 27th. In June 1941, Germany diverted major Luftwaffe units, its air force, from Africa to the Eastern European border. Why? I think you know. Now, all this time, the USSR was building up its forces. Stalin and the rest of the senior officers, the Stavka, knew that war with Germany was coming, but they straddled a knife edge. They needed to prepare for war while avoiding provoking Germany. The thinking was that they would not be ready for war before 1942, the next year, and they bet that Germany would not be either. They lost that bet. On the summer solstice, the longest day of the year, Germany launched Operation Barbarossa. It was the biggest land invasion in history, before or since. 3 million men with tanks, artillery, trucks, planes, and all the other equipment of war sprang across a 1,500-kilometer front from the Baltic to the Black Sea. They destroyed most of the Red Air Force on the ground in a few hours. Some German units drove as far as 90 kilometers on that first day. Within a few weeks, they had swept over the Baltic states and penetrated deep into Belarus and Ukraine. They encircled and destroyed or captured millions of Red Army soldiers and their weapons. At the very northernmost extreme of the USSR, German forces came from Norway toward Murmansk. The German forces, even with Finnish help, didn't get far. All along the front, from the very north to the very south, the Red Army fought back ferociously, with an intensity that caught the Germans, indeed the whole world, by surprise. But it did no good. The Germans just kept coming. Stavka, the senior command of the USSR, reorganized the armies and the fronts and assigned new commanders. Stalin even recalled General Dmitry Pavlov, who was commander of the Western Front, and had him shot for failure. The Soviets, though, they did do a lot of things right. Stalin ordered the scorched earth policy, ordering the armies and the civilians who retreated to take everything valuable with them. What they could not carry, they were to destroy. The Soviets managed to move hundreds of factories that made critical industrial and military equipment east beyond the reach of German bombers. And then they reassembled these factories in record time to churn out guns, tanks, ammunition, airplanes, everything else they needed. It would take months, but that's still incredibly fast for a project of this size. Hi, Scott here. I hope you're enjoying this episode and that you get a lot out of the whole podcast. Beyond Barbarossa is still, as far as I can tell, the only English language podcast in the world that focuses on the Eastern Front of World War II. If you do like it and you want to help me keep it going, please give it a rating or a review on Apple, Google, Amazon, Podbean, or whatever podcasting platform you listen to it on. That helps let other people know about it. Patreon's another way you can support the podcast, my research, and podcasting expenses. All you have to do is go to patreon.com/beyondbarbarossa and sign up at whatever level of support you choose. Patreon supporters get early, ad-free access to new episodes, as well as exclusive bonus episodes on topics like the Winter War between the USSR and Finland, and the pre-Barbarossa invasion of Poland by Nazi Germany and the Soviet Union in 1939. Check it out, won't you? Just go to patreon.com/beyondbarbarossa. Thanks. This episode is brought to you by the Eastern Front Trilogy, the true story of a Canadian, Maurice Bury, drafted into the Soviet Red Army in 1941, just in time to be thrown between the jaws of the USSR and Nazi Germany at the launch of the greatest land invasion in history, the monstrous war called Operation Barbarossa. In three volumes, Army of Worn Souls, Under the Nazi Heel, and Walking Out of War, the Eastern Front Trilogy is the story of the largest and deadliest side of the Second World War, seen through the eyes of a man who was there from the earliest days in 1941, through Germany's grinding occupation of Ukraine, and finally to the savage end of the war in Berlin. You can find the three individual volumes as ebooks exclusively on Amazon, or purchase a three-volume complete paperback on any online book retailer or at your local bookstore. To learn more about the Eastern Front Trilogy, visit scottburyauthor.com.
Did you know that the cappuccino was invented by a Ukrainian? Or that many first names, like Philip and Agatha, were brought to Western Europe by Ukrainian princesses? Or that a Ukrainian was the first female given the rank of officer in a modern army? Well, if you didn't, and even if you did, you can learn more about my podcast, Wandering the Edge, a podcast about Ukrainian history with a spot of travel, and all in English. And if you like Beyond Barbarossa as much as I do, because, well, it makes my life a whole lot easier since I don't have to do any episodes deep diving into the Eastern Front of the Second World War, please take a listen to Wandering the Edge for a deep dive into Ukrainian history, culture, and traditions. Find out more on wanderingtheedge.net. And now, let's get back to Scott, exploring and explaining the Eastern Front of the Second World War.
By mid-July 1941, less than a month after the launch of Operation Barbarossa, the German Army Group Center had reached Smolensk, along the same route that Napoleon had taken more than a century before. General Semyon Timoshenko managed to slow them down there until the end of July, but did not prevent them from victory and encircling more entire armies. Now, this is where some historians believe the Germans made a decision that lost them the war. On the other hand, there are many who believe the Germans never could have won in the first place. So let me explain this decision. Hitler started micromanaging the war in the East. And you know what? Up to that point, it was understandable. He had not been wrong yet. Not in Austria, Czechoslovakia, Poland, Denmark, Norway, the Low Countries, nor France. Not even Yugoslavia or North Africa. His decision to split the forces of Army Group Center. Its original goal had been to drive through Belarus, through Smolensk, straight toward Moscow. This would be a fatal blow that would cause the collapse of the USSR. The Germans thought they would reach Moscow by the 1st of August, or at the very latest, the 15th. But when they found themselves held at Smolensk, hundreds of miles west of the capital by that deadline, Hitler began to second-guess his generals. So he ordered half of the tank units of Army Group Center to go north to help the attack on Leningrad, and the other half south to attack Kiev, capital of Ukraine. Hitler really wanted Ukraine, its mineral wealth, its agricultural productivity, and the industrial output of the Donbass region. As I said, many historians, including David Glantz and David Stahl, point to this as one of several fatal German errors. The thing was, it did not look like a mistake at the time, nor did it for a long time after. The Germans reached the outskirts of Leningrad by September, That same month, Hurricane Guderian's panzer swept past Kiev. His panzer army and that of Hermann Hoth encircled nearly 700,000 men of the Red Army, the biggest encirclement of the war, but not the last. Then Hitler issued more changes to the strategy. Leningrad would not be captured, but encircled and starved. In September, the 900-day siege of Leningrad began. Over 1 million civilians starved and froze to death. Also in September, shipments of Western aid began arriving in the USSR under the Lend-Lease Act. The first shipment was from besieged Britain. Ships arrived in Murmansk on the Arctic Ocean coast, bearing 400 fighter airplanes, as well as pilots and mechanics to train the Soviets. Soon they'd be joined by tanks, guns, trucks, ambulances, radar equipment, radio sets, ammunition, raw materials, and food, mostly from the United States. By the end of 1941, 40% of the USSR's medium and heavy tanks were from Britain. Large quantities started to arrive in 1942, and this, especially the food, made the difference in the USSR's ability to fight. In the very southernmost part of Ukraine, the Germans reached the Petrikop Isthmus in September and began the invasion of the Crimean Peninsula. By October, the Germans had captured all but the Black Sea fortress of Sevastopol and the easternmost city of Kerch, but they would fall by the next summer. With Leningrad besieged and Ukraine occupied, Hitler shifted gears again. He ordered the panzers he had sent north and south to return to the drive on Moscow with Operation Typhoon in October 1941. All along, the Soviets had been counterattacking, or trying to. Stalin believed that the best defense was a good offense. The trouble was, the Soviets did not have the weapons, resources, or organization to do so successfully. Even though they were continuing to bring more forces, whole armies from the east, and raise more from the European areas still under the control. In fact, although the Germans were killing and capturing millions of men, the overall size of the Red Army grew to nearly double its size by the end of 1941, as it had been in June. The Germans drove on Moscow. Some forces reached as close as 19 kilometers from the city by the end of November, but they lost every step of the way. Guderian's once mighty panzer force, by the time Operation Typhoon ended in November, was down to 12 mobile tanks. Now, if you notice any weird noises, crackles, or hesitations on my part, that's because I've been joined by my intrepid helper here, Ragnar the Magnificent. He's a ragdoll cat, a very large one. Anyway, what would I do without him? So, back to the story. We're at November 1941. As a high school history class has taught us, General Winter hit, stopping the German advance. Of course, it wasn't that simple, but still, the weather basically shut down the Germans' plans. The winter of 1941-42 turned out to be the coldest in living memory in Russia, with temperatures down below minus 40 some nights. The Luftwaffe had to light fires under their planes to warm up the engines enough to start them in the morning. And the Germans, for reasons I still do not understand, did not have warm uniforms for their soldiers. Frostbite caused more casualties than bullets did. This is when the Soviets launched their first successful counterattack. Georgi Zhukov led the Battle of Moscow, driving the Germans back 100 kilometers from the capital, at great cost. It still astounds me how many casualties the Soviet leaders were willing to accept to achieve their objectives. I just can't avoid two thoughts. First, Zhukov and the other Soviet leaders knew they had the numbers to replace those they lost, those who were killed. And second, they didn't care about the individuals killed in these meat grinders. After all, the individual has no value under communism. Right? Back to the recap. On 7th December, as the Soviets pushed the Germans west of Maloyaroslavetsk, Imperial Japan launched a surprise attack on American Pearl Harbor on Oahu, Hawaii. This brought the United States into the war officially, even though they had been supplying the UK and the Soviet Union through the Lend-Lease program for a quarter of a year already. As the Japanese conquered Singapore, Hong Kong, and the Philippines, and the British approached El Agheila in North Africa, the Nazis decided on the, quote, final solution to the Jewish question in Europe, end quote. Which is a lie. They had been murdering Jewish people by the thousands from the beginning of the war, even before then. Now they just admitted, formally, that they were doing mass murder systematically. Hitler made an infamous speech at the Berlin Sportpalast, where he threatened to annihilate all the Jews in the world. In January 1942, General Erwin Rommel and his Africa Corps with Italian brigades took Benghazi, Libya, and threatened Egypt once again. Through the winter of 1942 and into the spring and even later, the Axis was ascendant. Japan took Java, Borneo, and New Guinea, and even bombed Australia. On the Eastern Front, Marshal Timoshenko launched a major offensive on 18 January in northeastern Ukraine. They advanced 100 kilometers, or 60 miles, destroying three German divisions. This created the Izyum-Barvenkovo salient, which would soon become even more important. Because in May, Timoshenko tried to exploit that salient. But the Second Battle of Kharkiv turned into another disaster for the Soviets as they ran through the German buildup for their next summer offensive, Operation Blue. Let's get into that. In the spring of 1942, Hitler changed the Wehrmacht strategy again. Case Blue, or Operation Blue's goal, was the oil fields of the North Caucasus and the steppe territory between the Black and Caspian Seas, up to the Caspian Sea port of Baku. This was an incredibly ambitious goal, even more ambitious than the original aim of Operation Barbarossa the previous year. Take a look at the maps on the webpage to see what I mean here. The distance all the way from eastern Ukraine to the Caspian Sea. Hitler wanted the oil of the Caucasus because oil and fuel shortages were hindering the progress of the Wehrmacht. Over and over again, the panzers and other vehicles had to stop just because they ran out of fuel. And the German mechanics were using unheard of quantities of lubricating oil to flush the dust out of their engines on the dry, dusty steppes of Russia and Ukraine. And their only reliable big source of fuel was the Ploiesti oil fields of Romania. Hitler also described Crimea as a, quote, land aircraft carrier, end quote, for Soviet planes, or for German ones if they could hold it. So the 11th Army, under General Erich von Manstein, later Field Marshal, completed the conquest of the Crimean Peninsula, including the hero city of Sevastopol and the Kerch Peninsula, by early July. Army Group South then split into Army Groups A and B. Group A captured Rostov-on-Don at the end of the Sea of Azov, then swept south and east across the steppe and the Caucasus Mountains toward the oil cities of Maikop, Grozny, and Baku. Meanwhile, Army Group B, including the German 6th Army under a new commander, General Friedrich Paulus, the 4th Panzer Army under Hermann Hott, the Italian 3rd and 4th Armies, and the 2nd Romanian Army, went more directly east to protect the flanks of Army Group A. In August, they reached Stalingrad at the bend of the Volga River, and that began the biggest and bloodiest battle in all history, a battle that lasted another 6 months. But back to the summer of 1942. This is the Axis's high watermark. Nazi Germany controlled Europe from the Atlantic to the Volga, and with now puppet Italy, from the Arctic Ocean to the Mediterranean, as well as most of North Africa. Rommel was outfoxing and defeating the Commonwealth forces, and it seemed there was nothing the British could do about it. The notorious raid on Dieppe on the Norman coast of France, conducted by mostly Canadian troops with some British commandos and American Rangers, was a complete disaster. More than half of the raiders were killed, wounded, or captured. The RAF lost 106 planes, and the Royal Navy lost 34 vessels. In the Pacific, the Japanese Empire reached its widest extent, holding much of China, Indonesia, Indochina. They chased away the British in Burma, they attacked the Aleutian Islands in the North Pacific, and battled American and Australian fleets in the Coral Sea. But by summer, they would start to suffer major defeats, losing battleships in the Battle of the Coral Sea, and 4 aircraft carriers, 2 cruisers, hundreds of aircraft, and thousands of men at the Battle of Midway, the turning point of the war in the Pacific. On the Eastern Front, Stalingrad was not the only major operation going on during the second half of 1942. The Soviets launched other big operations all along the Eastern Front. They took to giving their operations celestial names: Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, Neptune, and Mars. Operation Mars was an attempt by forces under Georgi Zhukov to destroy a major German salient or a bulge in the line around Rzhev, west of Moscow. This became Zhukov's greatest defeat, with over 100,000 men killed and 250,000 more wounded, and the destruction of 1,600 tanks. The Germans suffered some 40,000 casualties, a huge number, but not compared to the Soviet losses. And they did not have to retreat until they decided to the following spring, when they wisely abandoned the Rzhev salient as well as the Demyansk pocket. This straightened their line to more defensible, stronger positions and freed up dozens of divisions for other operations. But the fall of 1942 and the winter of 1943 saw the unraveling of the Axis. In November, the Americans finally got into the fight alongside the British with Operation Torch, landings in Morocco and Algeria. The British forces in Egypt pushed from the other side, squeezing the Germans and Italians into a shrinking toehold in Tunisia. They captured the last remaining Axis forces in Africa in May 1943. In November 1942, the Soviets' massive Operation Uranus surrounded the starving Germans and crushed them in February 1943. They even took the newly promoted Field Marshal Paulus prisoner. German Army Group A, which had never gotten close to its goal of the Caspian Sea, retreated north and west of the Don River. In February 1943, the Red Army pushed the Germans back from Leningrad far enough for them to build another railroad to bring in supplies to the starving city and evacuate some surviving citizens. June 1943 is the midpoint of the war on the Eastern Front, halfway in time between the launch of Operation Barbarossa on 21st June 1941 and the Soviet capture of Berlin in May 1945. So here's the situation at that midpoint. Lend-lease aid is pouring into the USSR. Millions of tons of food, clothing, weapons, ammunition, trucks, machinery, just about anything else you can imagine. Transported and reassembled Soviet factories are churning out thousands of tanks, planes, rifles, field guns, and other equipment every month. After stunning lightning-fast advances across Europe, the Axis forces have been stopped and are being pushed back, not only out of Africa, but hundreds of kilometers back from the Volga River and in Ukraine. In the far north, the German attempt to take Murmansk has failed miserably, even with Finnish help. In the Pacific, the Japanese have suffered losses they cannot recover from. The tide has turned, and the Allies have the initiative, even if not everyone can see it yet. Some people can, even some of Hitler's most senior generals. But that doesn't mean that the Allies have won. There are still 2 long years of war that will only get more and more brutal. 2 more years of millions of people killed, of cities and countries destroyed. Halfway through the war on the Eastern Front is a good place to end the second season of Beyond Barbarossa, still the only English language podcast that focuses on the Eastern Front of World War II. I want to thank all of you for listening to me for the past 2 years. Your encouragement and support have meant the world to me. I want to take a moment to acknowledge the generosity of the Patreon supporters and to welcome the newest, Tom Gaffney. Thank you. Thank you all very much. You may have noticed the new, grander arrangement of the theme song, a special for episode 50, composed and recorded, as was the original, by Nicholas Bury. Thanks. We're going to take a little break now, Barbarossites. Do you like that nickname? Or maybe Barbarossers, Redbeards? What do you prefer? Send your suggestions to contact@beyondbarbarossa.ca or through the Beyond Barbarossa Facebook page. You can also find me, Scott Bury, on Instagram @ScottBuryAuthor, on Twitter or X @ScottTheWriter, or on my website, scottburyauthor.com. And of course, you can visit the website for this podcast specifically, beyondbarbarossa.podbean.com. And you can hear the episodes on my other website, writtenword.ca. So there's lots of ways to contact me. Reach out. Season 3 will begin on, you guessed it, 22nd June 2024. And you history buffs can also guess what that episode will cover. But there's a lot more in store. Interviews with more authors and historians, bonus episodes on the most interesting people and events of the war, and deep dives into complex issues. You know as well as I do how complex the story of the war on the Eastern Front can be. In the meantime, let me know your thoughts. Do you have any questions, comments, suggestions, corrections? Send them in to those links I gave you before. Have a great spring, listeners. I'll talk to you again in the early summer. Until that time, keep your paddles in the water. Slava Ukraini.